Call the meeting to order. We do have a quorum. First item of business, members, if we could get someone to approve the minutes dated April 27th. Representative Hansen moves the minutes dated April 27th. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. We're going to, members, we have five bills up today. We're going to move the agenda around here a little bit. I know Representative Gruenhagen's in another committee right now, so he has to go later. Representative Torkelson, I believe, is ready to begin. So Representative Torkelson, I understand you want to take up House File 1572 first. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Would you like to go ahead and move that?
I'd like to move House File 1572 to be laid over for possible inclusion.
Representative Torkelson moves House File 1572 be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Torkelson, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is a bill dealing with pasture issues. I'm going to allow the PCA to testify first, and then we'll have other testifiers, I believe, that will step forward. So if the representative PCA would introduce himself, go ahead.
Good morning. My name is Randy Hookreed. I work for the Pollution Control Agency. I'm the Southwest Regional Manager out of the Wilmer Marshall region.
Welcome.
Thank you. It's the main point I wanted to bring up, that the reason that we oppose the legislation is it would set up a situation where the state of Minnesota would be less stringent than the US EPA. The bill as written would prohibit us from regulating operations that US EPA would regulate and potentially could require an NPDES permit for if the operations exceeded 1,000 animals. So it would put our delegation agreement in conflict with EPA because we would be less stringent than EPA and being unable to regulate that same group of operations.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you. If there are no questions for our PCA friend, I'll have him step aside and bring up another testifier that will testify in favor of the bill. Stay close.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, who you represent, and begin, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Bruce Clavin for the record. I represent the Minnesota State Cattlemen's Association. That's the beef cow group. And I don't know if dairy folks are interested in this as much, but in the bill, first let me just first tell you, we met with PCA a few weeks ago about this issue. The commissioner himself gave us an hour, along with Mr. Reed and some others, and we had a good conversation about this. I don't remember us reaching a resolution. This was put on the schedule yesterday. I didn't get any guys in here to talk about this, so I'll do my best on the bill. The essential issue that they have raised, the cattlemen have raised, is what does it mean to have a pasture? And back in, I want to say, 01, maybe, 2000 or 2001, when the feedlot rules were being proposed, there was an argument over whether pastures would be included in that. And so we ran a bill at that time that specifically exempted a pasture. And I think the common understanding was where you had grass or other growing plants where you would graze the animals over the summer. On the other hand was the feedlot itself, where there's not vegetative cover, it's over 1,000, you had to get the NPDES permit. And what they've told me is over the years there's gotten to be, at least from their understanding, some confusion over, for example, what happens when you put the cattle on a cornfield after the combine goes through and you let them graze either for the fall or all winter. It's not grass, but it's not a feedlot. And so the effort we were trying to make, the real focal point here, I think, is at the ends of lines 1.14 and 1.15. Pasture also means ag land where we have land used for cropping purposes. And that would be during the summer, of course. In either case, the concentration must be where you have to maintain vegetative cover, at least during the cropping or the grass season. I don't remember during our meeting hearing that this would put any jeopardy about the federal program. I don't remember that from the meeting, so when I first heard that today, that this is less stringent than the EPA, I guess I'm scratching my head over that. I don't know that that would be the case. The PCA has used in their fact sheet the test being the vegetative cover. So whether it's grass or corn, I don't know how that would be less stringent than the feds. We're also having an ongoing conversation with the PCA over federal conformity on this whole NPDES business in the first place. There's been court cases over the years, and the most recent one was handed down on March 15th, that makes the test for the NPDES permit not 1,000 animal units, as our state statute reads, but whether the feedlot proposes to discharge. And since we have a zero discharge standard, our argument for many years has been we don't need to get NPDES permits. Those are discharge permits. So to be less stringent than the feds on this pasture issue is new news to me. And I don't think, I know our state law has the test at 1,000, and we thought that was wrong back in 1998 when it was passed. We had arguments over that, and we're trying to change that. We tried it last year, and we're trying it again this year. So we're focusing on the discharge, not on the numbers, and that's in a different bill in the across the street. So that's the issue that we're trying to get at, and whether this is worded correctly or not, it has to do with putting them out on the cornfield.
So, Mr. Flavin, on the NPDES permit, wasn't there a federal ruling stating if you didn't have a direct discharge, you did not, you weren't required to have an NPDES permit? Am I accurate about that?
Mr. Chairman, that is what the court case has said. There's been a number of them, and I didn't bring that folder with me today on the whole NPDES part. But essentially, the test is whether you discharge, and we're having conversations with the PCA over what does it mean to have a discharge. There's a federal fact sheet on, for example, the guidance letter from the EPA suggests that if there's dust on the fan on the turkey barn and the rain comes and washes the dust off and somehow the dust makes its way down to the stream, that that's a discharge. I'm not saying that this is the PCA, this is the EPA guidance letter. I think that's a stretch, personally. A discharge would be maybe more in terms of the factory putting the pipe out in the stream. That would be a discharge. But that's what the court ruling said. If you want more information on that, I'd be happy to bring my folder to you someday, but I don't have it with me now. That's my memory from it.
Thank you. My other question is, you said something about if we're not out of compliance when it's on grass, when it's on pasture, why then, and this will be a question back to the PCA as well, why then would it be real out of compliance if it's on in a cornfield? And so, Mr. Humphreys, or either one, who would like to take that? If we're not out of compliance when we're on grass, why then are we being ruled out of compliance if we're on corn?
Representative Hamilton, Chair, what we're looking at and what EPA looks at is there a vegetative cover? So for a traditional pasture operation, there's generally vegetative cover, you know, during the growing season and then following after the cattle have been there. So with crop residue, generally speaking, with depending on the density that you're stocking the animals at, within a relatively short amount of time, the crop residue's gone, the food value's gone. And EPA, important point to make, bases their determination on what the residue is in the winter. So there is no, you know, cover, no residue there. So they're considering that to be a feedlot. So if that's, you know, the basis for what we're looking at. Is there a vegetative cover out there that would prevent runoff, etc.?
So to that point, both my father-in-law and my brother-in-law, my father-in-law, he just runs a couple hundred acres of ground, small farmer down there, and runs maybe 20, 30 head of cattle. What's a guy like that supposed to do if it snows? I mean, he has it out on pasture. He has it out on, he turns it out on cornfields as well. My brother-in-law has a few more head of cattle than that. But now all of a sudden, if it snows, which they can't, you know, prevent, now all of a sudden they're a feedlot? Is that what you're talking about?
Representative Hamilton, committee members, in that case, you know, we're not regulating requiring any permits at all for small operations like that. You know, what we're talking about here, requiring a permit, would be for facilities that have over 1,000 animals on site. So in that type of a situation, that would be under the regulatory thresholds. We're not going to require them to follow specific feedlot rules or obtain any kind of a permit. What we're dealing with here is the large operations over, in most cases, over 1,000 head.
So yeah, we'll have a few more questions. I have Representative Morrow.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, trust me, we don't necessarily want Mr. Clavin bringing his big folder right now, although I think there are significant MPDS issues that seem to come up that need to be resolved. Mr. Chair, I actually just have two questions, I think, for Representative Torkelson, if he might come back to the table.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Torkelson, this bill just got its first reading less than 24 hours ago, so I'm just trying to catch up if I understand the timing here correctly. I have no real objection, just more of a question as we look at subsection B, starting at line 1.12. I just don't know whether this is an acceptable definition of pasture to ag groups. I haven't had a chance to hear anyone chime in. Could we find out whether this definition is acceptable to the department, acceptable to ag groups, that it works? I'm just concerned, having just reading this language right now, that we don't do something we don't intend to do.
Representative Torps.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Moore and members. I will defer that to Mr. Clavin, actually.
Mr. Clavin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Morrow, the effort is on the cropping purposes. I don't know if there's a better way to state it. The cropping would pick up the non-existence of the grass during the growing season. In other words, it's pretty easy to tell if you've had cropping or not. Grass is, by definition, grass, and you're going to have it fenced. But what happens when you have a cornfield? Perhaps there's a better way to state it. This was our first effort at it.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would just add, it seems to me this is an activity that we would want to encourage if it's done properly, and that you're grazing fields where there may be leftover grain that's passed through the combine, and it's to the farmers and to the environment's advantage to properly graze that land and utilize that asset that's out there on the field. And hopefully the definition is tight enough that it avoids turning a cornfield into a feedlot.
We have a few more questions. Representative Paul Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. To the PCA, Mr. Jacobs, correct?
Randy Hookreed.
Okay, sorry, Randy. I talked to Mark Jacobs before. As I understand it, the areas around where the cattle would be feeding or watering more heavily traveled, they would be exempt from any nutrient buildup situations. Is that correct?
Mr. Hookreed. Chair, members of the committee, yes, that's correct. That's in the original exemption as it exists. The heavy traffic areas, chutes, waters, etc., are covered under the current exemption.
Representative Anderson.
So if an operator were careful to move around his a lot of times they use a big old tractor tire to feed and they're watering, and were careful to kind of spread those things around, and if they did maintain a corn stalk cover on this field, would that be adequate to say that practice is environmentally friendly and okay?
Mr. Hookery. Mr. Chair, representative of the committee, that's what we're trying to encourage, is keeping the density of the animals down, moving the feeders, the waterers, etc., around, so that as manure is applied, you do get a relatively uniform distribution of that manure. The other key point there is, again, is keeping that animal numbers under 1,000 animal units, which is where that regulatory threshold kicks in for permitting.
Representative Anderson.
And one final comment. A lot of these farmers that do this, it's really a short duration coming in after the combine, probably November sometime, and they like to get those cattle out of there by the time the frost leaves the ground. So it's a short duration, probably in November, out in March. Would that be correct to assume?
Mr. Hookery.
I'll defer to Representative or Mr. Clavin on that as far as practice. That's my understanding. That's what we commonly see.
Mr. Blaber?
Mr. Chairman, it actually would be kind of foolish to let something mound up in the cornfield and then you try to come in with the plant for the next year. Nothing's going to grow there. I mean, you're going to move that around to spread the nutrients throughout the field. That's just a practice you're going to do. The question is whether you need a permit or not to do that. And I know Representative Marlowe's talking to some of my colleagues, but he's in luck because I did bring one section of my folder for the next bill. It has the court case from March 15th. One of the key phrases here, and this deals with the EPA, but since the PCA is delegated, it would in theory apply to them. The Clean Water Act does not empower the agency to regulate the point sources themselves. Rather,
Excuse me, has their phone going. If you could shut that off, that's why we're getting the buzzing. So, sorry to interrupt.
No, that's fine. This is a key phrase, I think, in all of this. Clean Water Act does not empower the EPA to regulate the point source itself. EPA's jurisdiction under the operative statute, the Clean Water Act, is limited to regulating the discharge of pollutants. So what they would be doing here is regulating the point source itself as you move around the cornfield, rather than focusing on the discharge, which is zero. That's been our contention in the whole feedlot permitting deal that we worked on last year and again this year, as to whether we even need them in the first place.
Representative Anderson, follow-up?
No, I don't have any more follow-up.
Right, sure. Representative Torkelson?
Now, I think another question here is the difference between what we would think of as a traditional pasture and what we're identifying as a pasture with this legislation. And I asked our friend from PCA, you know, that 1,000 animal unit, would that apply to what we would refer to as a traditional pasture?
Mr. Hookery.
Representative Torkelson, members of the committee. If the operation is a quote-unquote traditional pasture, it's exempt from the feedlot rules. So they could run, you know, as many cattle as they wanted in that type of an operation. There wouldn't be a permit required in that case because pastures are specifically exempted, you know, what we'd consider a traditional pasture. And with EPA, too, I guess an important point to make is they do give a limited time period to bring, you know, cattle out there. They've got 45 days in their guidance that you're allowed to have cattle out there. Once the field's been denuded, there is no vegetative cover. So I think there is some recognition there that, you know, moving them around is a good practice. It's a good way to use that food resource. But that is one of the caveats in the EPA regulations is once it exceeds 45 days in a 12-month period, that's when they examine, you know, what are the animal numbers that are out there for determining whether or not there's a permit required.
And Mr. Hookery, my father-in-law and my brother-in-law would tell you traditional pastures, the corn stalks as well. So just a comment. Representative Torkelson, you had a comment?
Yeah, a follow-up on that. So then it seems that the argument then is that our effort here to kind of broaden the definition of pasture is not accepted by PCA, or they feel it would not be accepted by EPA. I guess that would be my question.
Mr. Hookery.
Representative Torkelson, members of the committee, our main concern, as we, you know, reiterated earlier, is that we would be in conflict with federal requirements. If they did exceed that 45 days within that calendar year, went over the 1,000 animals, they would be, in most cases, required to get an NPDES permit from the US EPA. If this passed, that permitting would be removed from the state of Minnesota, transferred to and issued by US EPA. And then any follow-up action, et cetera, would likely come from US EPA as well.
Representative Torkelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't really hear an answer to my question in there. Is the argument that this broadening of the definition of pasture invalid? Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Hookery.
Well, there's Representative Torkelson, members of the committee. Two concerns. There's a current definition of pasture in the statutes that this would be in conflict with potentially, and then I think this definition could be problematic in trying to administer the feedlot program in the state because we would have, you know, operations. I don't know that I can't answer the question specifically about the definition, but it would open up some problems that don't exist now with how those feedlots would be regulated.
Mr. Hookery, there is a problem now because that's why we're here. That's why the legislation is being brought forward. We've heard from cattle growers when they were up here, or cattle producers, when they had the day on the Hill, as far as some of the troubles that they're running into by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And one gentleman that was up here in particular, and he said he's got better things to do than spend his time up at the Capitol. Now he's talking about what the PCA is doing or how they're interpreting the laws, the rules, as soon as it snows. He says, how am I supposed to be able to run my operation? I can't determine when and how much it's going to snow. He said, I've been turning these out for generations, if you will, cattle on pasture ground or feeding them on or turning them loose on the corn ground as well. Now the PCA comes in and says, I can't do that anymore because I'm out of violation. I mean, we're here because there is an issue. So we do have some other questions. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question's on the other part of the bill, on the calendar question, on the 2010 and moving from the 10-year period of 1990 to 2000 to the 2010. And it's about what's the practical impact of this? So let's say you have a landowner who had pasture in 1998. And as the law, as the statute says, it says that that pasture is permanently exempt from requirements related to the feedlot or manure management as long as that property remains in pasture. And you're proposing to eliminate that portion and restart the clock in 2010. So what happens to the landowners who had, what's the effect of the proposed change to 2010 to the landowners who had pasture from 1990 to 2000?
Representative Torkelson, you'd like to take that, or?
I think I would like to defer to Mr. Clavin.
Yeah.
Mr.
Clavin.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to defer to the whoever wrote this. I have to tell you, I was put in this morning when the guys didn't come up. I don't know why that was put in there. Our focus was on Section B, and I don't want to put Mr. Sullivan on the spot, but do you I don't know why that was in there.
Mr. Sullivan.
Mr. Chair and members, a little behind the scenes on the drafting of this bill. The language that appears before the committee came to me originally drafted. I made a couple little tweaks to the language, but someone else requested that change, and that appears before you in the bill. I mean, my interpretation is if the person had pasture in 1998 and qualified, and in accordance with the law, they've kept it in pasture all along, when their clock restarts in this bill, they would still qualify. I mean, if in fact they did keep it in pasture throughout.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Sullivan.
Chair.
Representative Hansen.
However, if they had stopped and then restarted in 2008, they would no longer be eligible. Let's say there was a transfer within family, at a death in the family or something where you're no longer in. So I think there's a big unintended consequence question here on subdivision 7. The other part of it is in the progressive prospective nature of this, if having 2010, so you would have new, there might be some additional cost here on looking at restarting the clock in 2010 is to bringing new pastures in, and the unintended consequence of having old pastures drop out from a permanent exemption. And so I have some real world questions about the impact of that time change, and it appears that no one knows where that came from. So if it's an orphan provision, I would encourage striking.
Well, Representative Hansen, what I would like to do is I'll follow up, and Representative Torkelson, I'll work with you as well. I'm going to follow up on this because I know that I was talking to some of the cattle guys that were up here, and I'm going to circle back around. This will be held over for possible inclusion, and I'll get an answer for you as well. We have Representative Hansen. You have follow up on that, or all right, Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'm in support of this bill as one of the handful of members around this table that does hold a livestock feedlot permit and do raise beef cattle. I see this as just a practical, common sense approach to you know, the concerns with MPCA about you know, feedlot issues. to me, it would concern the accumulation, storage, transportation, and disposal and utilization of the animal waste. In a pasture lot setting, that's not a common practice. I don't know that anybody would ever endeavor to accumulate the manure from a pasture. Having just walked my pasture last weekend, I know that everything the cattle put down there last summer is still there. So, and I wish
watch
it would go away.
Step, right?
No, I just wanted to weigh in as a cattle feeder farmer that I think this is just a very practical approach to this issue.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Because some of these bills are getting to us from other committees late, I would move that we would suspend the rules for today.
Representative Anderson moves that we temporarily suspend the rules. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Anderson. Representative Torkelson, or the testifiers, do you have any final comments on this?
I guess my final comment would be that this is certainly not an effort to circumvent regulations that to protect our environment. It's an effort to put into statute a practice that commonly occurs and is really beneficial for our farmers and our farmland across the state of Minnesota. And I would follow up with you, Mr. Chair, saying that we will work to make this language appropriate and make it work for all parties concerned, if we possibly can. And with that, I would renew my motion to lay over 1572 for possible inclusion.
Okay. Representative Torkelson, before we do that, the Vice Chair, Paul Anderson, would like to say a few words as well.
Oh, I just had one more question, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the PCA. You mentioned that the NPDES permit would kick in after a 45-day calendar period. So if cattle were laid in December, would that clock start ticking over again January 1?
Mr. Hookery.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the way the EPA has interpreted that is it's 45 days within a 12-month period, so it doesn't start over again on the calendar year. They look at it a 12-month period.
Representative Anderson. So to that, Mr. Hookery, if... how much time in between, if the cattle producer pulls them off that ground, how much time do they have to wait before they can put cattle back on there in order to reset the clock, if you will?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there is no guidance in there on, X number of days, so I can't answer that question. I think we'd look at it, common sense, but... there's no guidance in there as far as if you bring them off for one day and bring them back again. Is it, if it's 45 days within that year, that's what they'd be looking at. So,
okay, thank you for that. Representative Torkelson, thank you for your closing comments. This bill will be held over for possible inclusion. Thank you. Thank you to the testifiers. Representative Porkinson, you have another bill up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 1509 for possible inclusion.
Representative Porkinson moved House File 1509 be held over for possible inclusion to your bill. Representative Porkinson, is there an amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, we have amendment that's labeled A11-0369. It's really a DE amendment in its nature. I'd like to move that amendment.
Okay. Representative Porkinson moves the A11-0369. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. To your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is really an agency bill that deals with the Clean Water Partnership Law, and I will ask a representative from PCA to step forward and explain the bill.
Welcome. Please state your name for the committee and who you represent. Begin, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Galen Reitz. I'm the director of the Regional Division of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency.
Welcome.
In 1987, the legislature created the Clean Water Partnership Program. and that's what this bill focuses on. Its purpose was to provide grants to local units of government to lead watershed projects to protect and improve surface and groundwater, and also to provide a legal basis for implementing the federal non-point source funds that the state receives through Section 319 of the Clean Water Act. Since 1987, over $36 million has been provided to local units of government for projects that improve water quality, and the local governments have matched the state money at the local level. So it's provided a significant amount of funds for local projects. Much has happened since 1987 as far as water quality programs. So what we're proposing here is a revision to really update the Clean Water Partnership Program. And so what we're doing here is eliminating references to activities that have already been completed since the law was originally enacted. We're making an effort to simplify and provide greater flexibility to address water quality protection and improvement restoration efforts. In the bill, local units of government that have been eligible to apply for the funds have not included soil and water conservation districts. They have been local partners in many of the projects, and so one of the things we're doing is making them eligible to apply directly. And then it'll also provide for further coordination and implementation of TMDL efforts in the state to restore impaired water. So just to very quickly and briefly walk through what's included in the bill, Section 1 is in here. It actually refers to the Department of Agriculture's Ag BMP loan program, and it's only in here to do the strikeout that is on line 1.6, which is a conforming change to the repealer that is later in the bill. So it's just to clarify that that the section it refers to is going to be repealed. Secondly, Section 2, the purpose is essentially to remove some of the language of work that has already been completed and that was a bit redundant, and so it's just clarifying that language. Section 3 simplifies the description of a project which would be funded through this effort and should allow it to be more integrated with other programs that we now have and less prescriptive than it's been in the past, again, providing us more flexibility. Section 4 removes a reference to work that was done in the late 80s and removes a reference to non-point source pollution. This is being done because the definition of non-point source pollution through a series of court decisions has actually become much narrower, and we want to try and remain broad as far as what kind of problems can be solved through this program. An example of the narrowing of the definition of non-point, urban stormwater in the 80s was considered non-point source pollution. That's now, for the most part, a regulated point source as a result of various activities that have occurred. Section 6 just adjusts the maximum available through the loan program, which is a subset of this. Section 7, and I should say on that Section 6, it's just an authorization. It isn't an actual allocation of funds. Section 7 establishes local units of government that are eligible to apply, and it requires that the activities that are fundable through this program be identified through local water plans or a TMDL implementation plan to be eligible for project funding. And it also establishes that soil and water conservation districts can be local sponsors. They've often served as a project sponsor, although in cooperation with either a county or another local unit of government. This would allow them to come in directly and apply for the funds. Section 8, 9, 10, and 11 essentially go through and make consistent the earlier changes that I've mentioned throughout the rest of the bill, so removes references to work that was already completed to between the late 80s and 90s. Then the repealers, subdivision 103F, 711, subdivision 7, the definition of official controls, and 103F, 731, the eligibility of assistance, were actually the two lines that excluded soil and water conservation districts from being able to apply. The repealer for 103F, 721, statewide resource assessment, has been completed, so that's why we're taking that out. And then 103F, 761 is a project coordination team, interagency team that reviewed and ranked projects. There are other teams that now exist that we would use instead of keeping another team alive that's specifically defined in this bill. So that's a quick overview of what's included in the bill.
Mr. Reitz, this is exciting stuff. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just add that this bill was heard in the Environment Committee and passed. There were some concerns that were brought up in that committee. We've done our best to address those concerns with the changes in language that have been added in the amendment that's been passed here in committee this morning. I ran those changes past Representative Hansen earlier this morning, and I would like to get him on the record as verifying that we've made the changes that were requested in a previous committee.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Torkelson, yes, we did look at this. I did have one question for you, though.
Please, go ahead.
Throughout the delete all, the word protect appears, and I'd just like to clarify that the word protect does not mean acquire. Is that your understanding of the word protect, Representative Torkelson?
Thank you,
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. Yes, that is my understanding.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The provisions are good. I think it adds the delete all adds a lot of clarity. There was a provision on soil and water in the part I saw this morning that I think the 369 actually resolves that on lines 5.12, 5.13, 5.14 by just saying local stakeholders. And I think that was the difference, Representative Torkelson, to the question I had this morning. And this is, I think, resolved. Is that your understanding?
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Jack. So your question related to lines 4.14 through 4.16.
Okay.
And perhaps we want to change some of them to an or to make that a little clearer that they don't have to consult with everyone. I don't know if that was your concern there or not.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think maybe the word is putting in applicable or the affected soil and water district or watershed districts, because you may in the metro area have a soil and water district with six watershed districts which are not affected by the application. And I would look for PCA's guidance on maybe a one-word oral amendment that would affect that.
Mr. Eats.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, and unfortunately, well, fortunately, I was involved when this was originally written in 1987, and the reason these lines were here was the conservation districts and watershed districts were both interested in being consulted where applicable, and so I think the original is where they exist to kind of cover if they were there and affected by that. So I'm not sure if that's adequate or not. I know that both of the groups are very interested in still being consulted being consulted in each situation, not only if somebody thinks it's applicable. That's always left up to
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe the way is on line 4.14 before the word local, including the word involved.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I think that would be fine.
I would move that oral amendment.
All right, so will you restate that, please, Representative Hansen?
On line 4.14, between the word the and local,
yes,
insert the word involved.
Does everybody have that? Is that Representative Torkelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would accept that as a friendly amendment to the bill.
Okay. Representative Torkelson accepts the word involved be added on line 4.14 between the word the and local. All right. So since that's a friendly amendment, do we need to vote on that? All right. We will vote on that. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. We do have a couple other questions. Representative Hansen, you okay?
Yes.
You all right? Bruce, Representative Anderson, Bruce.
Sorry. Representative Torkelson, in your delete all amendment, it talks about on line 2.29, new language, prevent water pollution. Is there a definition in statute? And what is there a criteria to meet that requirement there that you're putting in statute, adding to the project?
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Anderson. I would ask that the PCA respond to that question, looking at lines 2.29 and language referring to prevention.
Mr. Reitz.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, was it?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The phrase prevent water pollution, is that, just for clarification, that's what you were asking about?
Representative Anderson, yes.
Yes. I am not aware that there's a definition in statute. I think we understand that to mean that it's an effort to avoid water pollution, which may mean best management practices, other actions or activities to avoid water pollution.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sir, what's the consequences if you don't?
Mr. Reitz.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, in this case, where we're talking for the most part about non-point sources of pollution that aren't regulated, there aren't consequences. The intent here of the Clean Water Partnership is to provide financial and technical assistance to local units of government to avoid water pollution. We're making a huge investment in the state to restore impaired waters, and I think this is a recognition that to the extent we can avoid waters becoming impaired through preventing water pollution, we're going to be money ahead. And so it's an effort to avoid further impairments or additional impairments and the costs related to that.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, so who makes that determination?
Mr. Eats.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, we are required by the Clean Water Act, all states are, to assess waters and identify which water bodies. Assessment means to monitor and to then compare to water quality standards and identify those water bodies that are not meeting water quality standards. Those are then listed as impaired waters, and that's done through the Pollution Control Agency as the delegated EPA program manager, essentially. And so we go through an assessment process every 2 years and look at where water quality has been monitored, compare against the standards. There's a professional judgment team that reviews that comparison. We public notice those water bodies that are potentially going to be listed as impaired. It goes through the public comment period, and then that list is submitted to EPA, who then reviews it.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
So that criteria, those standards, should be the determination for preventing water pollution?
Mr. Reitz. Mr. Chairman, I think those standards are what those water quality standards are, what we try and maintain the water above, and so we prevent any pollution that would impair them or take them below the standard.
Mr. Anderson?
Well, Mr. Chair, it's not clear.
Noted. To this point, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To this point, Representative Anderson, I think where this provision is citing this project, to give you an example, you may have a landowner, a farmer, coming to a Soil and Water District and says, I'd like to put a filter strip in, you know, bread and butter soil and water conservation that's existed for 60, 70 years, that type of practice. But that is not a cleanup, which the old way that you would have the statute of we'd only fund cleanups. That would be a prevention thing that would prevent soil from getting in the water. And the way the bill is amended now, where a project, what you could fund, is you could fund that prevention project. You could fund that water filter strip that the landowner could have, and you could have a clean water partnership provide money as cost share. So I think I understand where you're coming from on the standard side, but what this does under the project is it allows some of the clean water partnership money to fund these preventive activities so we're not doing cleanup, and that landowners could implement and get some help on those projects. That's the intent of putting prevention in there, to get good practices that we know both on the science side but on the practical implementation. If we implement them and get cost share, they'll prevent water problems in the future. So am I right, Mr. Reed?
Mr. Reeds.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, thank you. Yes.
Representative Anderson, you want to follow up? Are you all right?
Nope. Not all right, but I'm not going to follow up.
All right. Thank you. Representative Hansen, I think you just got a job at the PCA. I'm teasing. Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question on Section 7 and Section 8. Proposals has replaced applications. So I'm just curious about the definitive difference and the practical difference between a proposal and an application.
Mr. Eats.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, what we're trying to do here, when this program first started, we had fairly prescriptive applications, which we found became almost an expense just in preparing the application to try and receive the grant money. What we're trying to do is simplify the program enough that people can make a proposal, another word for application, such that it shouldn't cost half the project to put together your application. So we're trying to simplify, make it more flexible, and so we just to break from where we'd been to where we're going, we decided to use a different word. It's still an application, but we're going to simplify and make it so that the application should be easier and less expensive to complete.
Representative Poppy? Thank you. All right. Any other questions, members? Seeing none. Representative Torkelson, any final words?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is, as I mentioned earlier, an agency bill, but we've worked pretty hard over the last few days to make it a better bill, and I would renew my motion to pass the bill as amended for possible inclusion.
Representative Torkelson renews his motion to House File 1509 as amended be held over for possible inclusion. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Mr. Reitz, as you're leaving, you know, you said it's beneficial that you've been around, what, 1980 something another. The Commissioner of Agriculture was in my office this morning, and he was explaining to me a bill that was put on the books like around 1920, 1930, and I said, it's a good thing you're around back then, Commissioner. So, thank you for your testimony, Mr. Reitz. We'll take up Representative Anderson's bill, House File 1122. And Representative Anderson, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Good morning, members of the committee. I'd like to move House File 1121 is the number I have for possible inclusion, Mr. Chair. And I do have an amendment that I would like to include as well.
Representative, pardon me.
What was it?
Representative Anderson, 1120.
Okay, you're correct, Mr. Chair. It's 22.
Yeah. I'm going to ask that you withdraw your previous motion, if you would, please. And modify that. I'd like to send this both on that. You've been through the Environment Committee, correct?
Yeah.
And you've been here. It wouldn't need any other stops. I'd like it to go on to the House floor and be held over for possible inclusion as well. So with that, would you reflect that, please, in your motion?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 1122 for possible inclusion. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to move to the House floor?
Be recommended pass, be placed on the general register. Okay, so Representative Anderson moves House File 1122, be recommended to pass, and be moved to the general register, and also be held open for possible inclusion. To your bill, Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And we would also want to move the DE1 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm. Representative Anderson moves the DE1 amendment. Does everybody have that?
No.
I don't think so.
Yep.
Mr. Chairman, that's written to 1121, but it would apply to both.
That was to
1121. Oh, this
one.
Okay, got it.
So, Mr. Sullivan, the DE1 amendment that we have in our packet was written to 1121. So the proper motion?
I think the proper motion would be for the author of the amendment, if it is to be placed on the 1122 House file instead, would be just on page one, line one of the amendment to strike 1121 and insert 1122.
That would be my motion, Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson moves an oral amendment on the H1121 DE1 amendment on line 1.1. Strike 1121 and replace that with 1122. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. So, you want to move the DE1 amendment as amended?
I would move the DE1 amendment as amended, Mr. Chair.
All right. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. To your bill as amended, Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. This bill represents a concern that those in production agriculture have with the concern to how application of pesticides are regulated here in our state of Minnesota. And the bill was heard in the Environment Committee, and some concerns were raised, and rightly so, that we want to make this a narrow application just to production and terrestrial or ground applications of chemicals to agriculture. And concerns were raised about it possibly affecting the bill as it was written, how it may affect mosquito control spray, things like that. So we had some changes made. And to further explain those changes, I'd like to call on Mr. Clavin, Mr. Chair. And he would help us to walk through the changes made and what those changes would do.
I'm sorry, Representative Anderson, was that a question? I had a sidebar with Representative Egan.
I'd just like to ask Mr. Clavin to further explain the changes made and further explain the bill.
All right, Mr. Clavin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Bruce Clayton. I work for the Minnesota wheat growers, barley growers, all three sugar companies, the potato growers, and some others. Others in the room here, Mr. Peterson, Raddatz, Mr. Schoenfeld, and some others are also interested in this bill, but they won't all come up and address you. Maybe just quickly, housekeeping on your agenda, you'll see 1121, 1122. Those are clone bills. The reason they're clones is across the street there's a five-author limit. And we had more than five authors interested in this issue, so we had two versions of the bill. One of them sits in the Ag Committee across the street. The other one sits in the Environment Committee. And sending them both out today will help with the deadline. There's
Mr.
no issues
Clavin,
over there.
It's my bill's better than Representative Anderson's, just for the record. Mr. Clavin.
Thank you. So just so that the members know, there's nothing nefarious about that. I had a conversation with Representative Morrow about the addition of that one prior to the committee. We talked about that. So just so members know, it's they're clone bills, so there's nothing goofy about it. Mr. Chairman, quickly to the issue here, I can give you the Reader's Digest version of the EPA, the state action, and then the bill itself. And some of you heard this Tuesday morning, so I'll try to be quick. There are two federal acts in play here as it relates to the application of pesticides, and pesticides includes a broad category. That's insecticides, fungicides, herbicides, anything in that category. Both acts date back to the early 70s. The one we have been following and the one that the Department of Ag administers is called FIFRA, the Federal Insecticide, Rodenticide and Fungicide Act. All products, even the Raid under your kitchen counter, is governed by that act. And on the can, whether it's Roundup or Raid or anything, you have to follow the label, and the label's the law. If you don't follow the label, you're subject to an enforcement action by the Department of Ag. This has been for years. We have training on this. We work with the Department of Ag on this to make sure it's done as right as possible out in the field. That act governs the product. On the other side, we have the Clean Water Act. The Clean Water Act governs the addition of pollutants into the water, and we've talked about that already this morning. And in order to do that, you need an NPDS permit, a National Pollution Discharge Elimination System permit, in order to put a pollutant into the water. Those two acts collided after about 40 years, back in 2001, out in the western part of the country. It was in the Ninth Circuit. Somebody used, I think it was an airplane, to spray some national park or something, and there was a lawsuit over it, but the point of the case was that the sprayer nozzle was determined to be a point source. And that was the first ruling that that had ever happened, where that definition had been made. There was another court case in 2002, and between the two of them, the ruling was that not only was that a point source, but when you put the product in the water, say for mosquito control, that was the addition of a pollutant to waters. And so the court rulings essentially ordered the EPA to go back and say, you have to put a permit program in place using your NPDES authority to govern the addition of these pollutants into water. And the EPA said at the time, this was about in 2006, we're not going to go there. There's too many. This is crazy. We're not going to do it. So they put out a rule saying we're not going to do spraying because that's governed under FIFRA. It's already regulated. And, of course, there was another lawsuit over this. They lost, and the court said, yes, it's governed under FIFRA, but because it's the addition of a pollutant to waters, you still need the permit. So they went back to the drawing board, and that's the subject of our bill today. EPA spent 2 years putting their draft together, and to comply with the court, they put out four use patterns. First is flying insect control, mosquito control. You put that in the water. There's a forest canopy. There's aquatic nuisance animal control, and there's aquatic vegetative control. All of those involve water or the potential for water in the forest example. So if you're going to spray mosquito control into the water, you need the permit. So that's the federal rule in a nutshell. The EPA, because they're delegated to do the federal program, put out their state draft in January, just a couple of months ago. The PCA. They largely followed the EPA permit draft in most ways. The four use patterns they adopted, and they put out their draft. But there are two differences that we noted in our review of the draft permit back in January. The first is that the PCA proposal goes farther than what the feds do, in our view. And that is, they do this program for waters of the state. The court case and the federal EPA require this for waters of the U.S. And you might be wondering, of course, what's the difference? There's a difference in definitions. The definition under the federal law is that water of the U.S. is navigable. Now, I recognize there's lots of arguments over what is and what is not navigable. Some of you might have followed the former Congressman Oberstar's bill at the federal level. He was trying to get at that word navigable and further define it. But that's the waters of the U.S. The waters of the state is a long definition, and it basically covers any accumulation or body of water within the state borders. So it's much more expansive, much more. All your lakes, streams that don't leave the state aren't navigable. Those are waters of the U.S. The second difference that we saw was a sentence in their fact sheet. And I know they've heard me say this a number of times, but this was concerning to us in the ag industry, and this is the focus of our bill. PCA said in their draft document, while these four use patterns, the permit only covers the four use patterns involving water, the existence of those permits does not eliminate the need that other types of applications that result in point source discharges to waters of the state might need to get a permit. This was the red flag for us. What other kind of applications would there be but terrestrial, which is what we do on the dirt? And so we put the bill together to try to prevent the PCA from someday requiring a permit to spray a cornfield. Now, that might be paranoia. Some maybe would argue that. We have experience with this on the livestock side of this. We've talked about that this morning already. And that's what led to the bill. So if we turn to the DE1, our bill is quite simple, really. And it's kind of reversed now because of the session law. In your bill, the second paragraph is listed first, but because part of this was adopted in the Ag Conference Committee, some of you might remember this debate we had that day, it's listed second. I want the members to know and point this out that if you start on lines 1.15, where it starts, the commissioner has, that sentence was adopted in the Ag Finance Conference Committee that some of you were on. The second sentence we had a debate over in the Ag Conference Committee that day. It was different in that bill. It talked about public waters. We tried to bridge the gap between waters of the state and waters of the U.S. What we've proposed here is to specifically say, except as provided in Subdivision 3, which is a section of this that the Department of Ag delegates, say, to the DNR to do control on their land, a state agency other than the MDA shall not regulate or require permits for the terrestrial or non-aquatic application. As Representative Anderson pointed out, some of this change came from our conversation in the Environment Committee 2 days ago. Representative Hanson raised some issues about what does it mean to be terrestrial. So we tried to use the word non-aquatic as an effort to try to do that. And we also dropped from the conference committee the conversation over waters. Simply say, no other agency can make you get a permit to spray the cornfield. That's the effort here. Up on the top, and you'll notice on lines 1.3, that's chapter 115.03, that's the waters chapter, it's PCA jurisdiction. That was what was discussed more in the Environment Committee. We didn't make any changes there. That paragraph there gets at that waters of the state versus waters of the U.S. I know there's a disagreement about this. The agency has concerns about administering it. But we wanted to point out to the members that the EPA only requires that you go so far as waters of the U.S. It does not require that you pick up every water body in the state. And there's some thresholds they have in their permit proposal. But that was our effort. And Mr. Chairman, members, that's the bill in a nutshell.
Thank you. Is there any questions? Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Anderson and Mr. Clavin. I appreciate the addition on line 1.18 that relates to DNR permitting for aquatic applications. So I think that recognizes some of the concerns we had. One of the questions, though, was Mr. Clavin, I'd asked you about permitting, that it might be an actual benefit to you if the Pollution Control Agency did a blanket permit for a specific type of application. For example, rather than requiring individual aerial applicators to get a permit for an application, but stating that, say, a application that's dealing with forest tent caterpillar, all applications are permitted within a period of that the Pollution Control Agency would issue on behalf of that type of application. It would appear the way your bill is written now, that would prohibit that, when that it may actually benefit some types of industrial users.
Mr. Chairman, yes, Mr. Representative, I remember that from the committee, and then we talked about it yesterday. The forest canopy in their draft permit would probably cover that. They would have to get that to do forest, maybe even hybrid poplars. I don't know what the extent of the forest canopy would be, but that's already going to be required from that standpoint. Using an area application over potatoes would not. So the forest canopy, and I guess I don't know if there's a draft, PCA might know this from their permitting, if there was a federal definition or limit on what a forest canopy was.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was using forest canopy as an example. Maybe I'll use a more familiar one. Let's say there's an outbreak of, this is less of a problem now with some of the BT products that are in various crops, but I remember corn borer infestations, or let's say there's a spider mite outbreak that requires a confined, Representative Hamilton, I remember in your area maybe 10 years ago, there was some immediate, we had to bring aerial applicators in from out of state, and that was an agricultural application that maybe a blanket permit would be beneficial in a timely nature. So I still have concerns. Maybe the bottom line here is I still think there's a number of unintended consequences with what is being proposed. I think you've moved partially here. I see there's layover but that's one question I'd like maybe resolved here for the
Sure.
Sclavin.
Mr. Chairman, in the case of a corn borer or something like that, that would still be a terrestrial application. The out-of-state folks come in That's a licensing issue, I think, in terms of commercial applicators versus a permitting. The permitting would be getting permission from the PCA to spray for the corn borer. It would still be a terrestrial application. In the case of soybean aphids, for example, you go ring around the field. That's all you need to do, but that would still be terrestrial.
Some hands.
Mr. Chair, but that gets to the point, Mr. Clavin, on going back to the top on federal law that we have, if you require as part of the permit that people have to demonstrate a minimum level of competency, Minnesota has gone beyond the federal law in terms of the demonstration of competency, that you could, in a number of states, you can just walk in, show up, put an X next to your name, and all of a sudden you're certified to apply. That'd be the federal standard, whereas we require a greater measurement of competency in order to apply. So then your other provision as part of the permit on going back to federal law as being the default, you are then walking backwards as part of that permit because there's likelihood of applicability to all federal laws rather than the state law. That's the crux of the potential problem.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative, I think if I understand what you're saying, that the licensing versus the permitting, we go beyond in Minnesota, arguably, that we require all the applicators, commercial and private, to get a three-year license and so forth. That wouldn't change, and that's actually something we support, but it wouldn't be related to the permit. That we just do anyway, and that's beyond what FIFRA requires, but it's something that the Department of Ag administers. But that's independent of whether you get permission from the PCA to do the application. I understand what you're asking, but it would be it's completely separate.
Or Zahans.
Unless you have the permit for the application, you go going back up to the component of the permit, the MPDS, that would be cross-referencing other statutes. That's where you go backward. And that's my particular concern here. And, you know, maybe we can hear from both agencies on that. I don't think we want to go backward on cross-referencing, because usually you have applicability for all federal, state laws or appropriate laws. By writing into statute going back to the federal default, then I don't want to have an unintended consequences of our existing beyond federal minimums not being appropriate.
Mr. Clavin?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What we're trying to do, and I understand exactly what you're asking, what we're trying to focus on is the issuance. It's the act of the issuance, maybe not necessarily the terms, but whether the PCA could require an issuance that goes beyond those four use patterns. And I know, I remember Representative Purcell raised this in environment about what about the feds? Why are they so wise? We don't know that they are so wise here and that we want to go with the federal default. We're not sure that they're doing the right thing. And by the way, two members, you should know that Congress, at least the House, has passed this out of committee, a bill to repeal this entire thing. I don't know what will happen with that, but others are recognizing the redundancy of this finally in Congress.
Representative Hansen, follow up?
Mr. Chair, and on that point, we should be clear for this committee. I don't know if it was explicitly said that this isn't something that EPA has just cooked up there under court order to be dealing with this. And so it's very clearly this is a court-directed initiative. That EPA is having to promulgate rules in a very tight timeline, and they've extended those rules. And then the Pollution Control Agency here as a delegated responsibility is having to react to those. The way that the bill is written, would this allow for the Department of Ag to issue a general permit in consultation with the Pollution Control Agency for NPDES? An NPDES permit for a terrestrial application, could the Department of Agriculture issue a permit for any of the examples that we've just discussed?
Mr. Clavin?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Hansen is correct that this is an under court order, and that's what's brought this whole thing forward. And that's really actually why we brought the bill, was to stay as close to that court order as possible and not go off in a whole bunch of different directions. In terms of whether the Department of Ag could require a permit, at least in NPDES one, they don't have delegated authority from the EPA. So they may have better answer the question, but my understanding would be that they would not be able to because they don't have the delegated authority.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, the DE-1 talks about from the Ag Department delegation to other agencies. I am assuming there may be delegation language among the other agencies to other agencies as well. So a memorandum of agreement or a delegation agreement cooperative, collaborative authority agreement, maybe tools that are there for implementation on this. And I think we probably need the agencies to see if that authority is there, where under a delegated agreement from the PCA to Ag, they could issue.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. You raise a good point, Representative Hansen, and I think you're getting more at the area of competency if the applicator is competently licensed to do the to do the job. And I would say that that would remain in the under the realm of the Department of Ag to make sure that we all are licensed and properly trained to do the job in the correct way. And I wouldn't see this as affecting that Department of Ag licensing procedure, either commercial license or, in my case, a private pesticide application license, that we read the labels and do the job in the correct way.
Any further discussion? Representative Anderson, I think. Mr. Sullivan? Do you feel comfortable commenting on the question that I have presented to you via a note? Do you feel comfortable commenting on that? My question to you is on that motion. I had a dual motion, or actually it's Representative Anderson's motion, to send this to as amended to the General Register. And then he also included be held over for possible inclusion. It's my understanding that, I was told two different things. One, that we could send it to the General Register, and any bill that's heard in here can be held over for possible inclusion. And I've also heard that that motion was acceptable as is. Would you like to, do you feel comfortable commenting on that?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I think both the options that you just described there would be valid. I've certainly seen it in the past where bills have been sent from this committee to the General Register, and then they have appeared as part of the committee's omnibus policy bill. I think that's within the chair's authority to do that. Talking to Mr. Reinholtz about the dual motion to send it to the floor and lay it over, we think that that's, although maybe unusual, that would be fine, that's the chair's prerogative to make that kind of motion if he so chooses.
I'll do what I want. I'm just teasing. the power, though. So, Representative Anderson, I think what I'm going to ask you to do is, and I think the PCA would like to testify. And I'm going to ask if there's anybody who would like to testify for or against this bill as well. But as they're making their way up, Representative Anderson, I'm going to ask that you withdraw your original motion and make the motion as recommended to pass, as amended, and be sent to the General Register. Okay? That's the new motion before us. Thank you, Representative Anderson. Please state your name, who you represent for the record, and begin, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Stein. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency. We're here to look at the amendment that's before you and also offer our brief testimony. As been stated by Mr. Clavin, the Pollution Control Agency is delegated for the Clean Water Act authority in the state. One of the things we note in the amendment language is the limitation of the NPDES permits for waters of the United States. That's a subject I've had some experience with after working at the Department of Natural Resources for 25 years as a hydrologist, last 6 years at the Department of Health, and now at the Pollution Control Agency. The determination of waters of the United States is a term of congressional language. It is federal authority. There is not any experience in the state in making such determinations as to what constitutes waters of the United States. Waters of the United States are typically defined through a test of several forms. One is navigability, as Mr. Clavin pointed out. The other is interstate commerce applicability. There isn't a we're just discussing with my colleagues in that whether the state has ever made a determination of what waters of the United States are, and we do not have any recollection of that. We certainly have had a number of experiences defining waters of the state, and that's our authority for our water protection and water pollution control programs is for waters of the state. So we operate our program, our water protection programs for waters of the state, and this sets up a conflict for the agency that we would find difficulty administering. Also, with regard to Representative Hansen's comment, were the agency to delegate its permitting and national pollutant discharge elimination system permitting program to the Department of Agriculture, that would require us to consult with the Environmental Protection Agency about that delegation. We haven't done that before in this state, but it's something that we could pursue. It's unknown whether or not that would actually meet with the Environmental Protection Agency's approval. And further, I'm not sure that the Department of Agriculture would be amenable to that delegation in the first place. So those are some unknowns about that particular situation. And, Mr. Chair, I'd answer any questions committee members may have at this time.
Thank you, Mrs. Stein. We do have a question. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, in your statement about EPA and our State Department of Agriculture, is there any precedent that you're aware of where a state pollution control agency delegating that authority, or Department of Agriculture within a state taking over that authority? And I have a follow-up.
Mr. Stein.
Mr. Chair, Representative Purcell, not to our knowledge in Minnesota. We've not done that to our knowledge in Minnesota. I'm not aware if that's occurred in any other state. I'd have to go back and ask my colleagues whether that's been done to their knowledge.
Representative Purcell.
And then if it was done, would the State Department of Agriculture then, there would be some reporting from the Department of Ag to US EPA that would follow in order to meet the standards of the stipulations of that delegation that the state takes from the federal. Is that correct?
Mr. Stein.
Mr. Chair, Representative Purcell, clearly it's hypothetically true that there'd be some kind of reporting relationships. As I said, would also require the Department of Agriculture's willingness to accept that delegation.
Representative Purcell. Any further questions to this testifier? Seeing none at this moment. Mr. Schoenfeld, welcome. State your name for the record. Who you represent?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Jerry Schoenfeld. I work with the Minnesota Soybean Growers Association. I just wanted to add one thing to this, and that's a lot of discussion about waters of the United States, waters of the state, public waters, all these different definitions. So maybe at least to get on the table, the concern that people like the soybean growers have got about this and the discussion about the terrestrial application. The concern we've got is that there, on the one hand, you have an application, the licensing, and all those kinds of things that go with that. But in addition to that, then, what authority is there, an underlying authority for PCA to come in and say, well, yeah, you can license those people and you can govern how they spray and all those kinds of things, and they have to follow FIFRA. But because they affect waters of the state, we can also do this permit. That's really what the crux of this is. And I'll read to you the definition from Chapter 115 as to why we would be concerned about this. The waters of the state, subdivision 22, chapter 115, says waters of the state means all streams, lakes, ponds, marshes, watercourses, waterways, wells, springs, reservoirs, aquifers, irrigation systems, drainage systems, and all other bodies or accumulations of water, surface or underground, natural or artificial, public or private, which are contained within, flow through, or border upon the state or any portion thereof. Now that is every raindrop that hits the ground. And so that is our concern here, trying to... And so when PCA talks about, well, we're in charge of waters of the state, yeah, they are. That's exactly our concern and the reason for the bill. Because it is everything that's out there, including, as by state law, drainage systems and irrigation systems. And that's our concern, and I don't know how you cut you know, cut the pie any differently exactly in trying to do this. In terms of wires to say, I think Mr. Clevin can add that the federal court decision, as I understand it, requires water of the United States, as indicated in this bill. And as I understand it, that can fulfill what the federal court requires. There's this other discussion that goes on, but there are several states that are doing just exactly that, waters of the United States. And I'll turn that over to Mr. Clevin to identify which states are doing exactly.
Mr. Clevin. Quickly, Mr. Chairman, there's a split on authority. Out of the 50 states, 44 are delegated by the EPA to carry out the Clean Water Act. Six are not. Right off the bat, those six are going to follow the waters of the U.S. definition, not the waters of the state. The most recent list I got, and I can't remember, this is from a national group that was forwarded on, but Virginia, Arizona, Texas, California, if you can believe that, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, New Mexico, Idaho, Oklahoma, Arkansas, the District of Columbia, U.S. territories, and Indian country lands are all going to follow waters of the U.S. South Dakota, New York, New Jersey, South Carolina, Ohio, Florida, and a bunch of others are going to do waters of the state. And then there's states that I don't have on this list. I don't know where they're going. But the point I'm making is a whole bunch of other states are able to make a determination as to what's a water of the U.S. and what's not. So it's split, and I wanted the members to know that. Representative Purcell was touching on that. It doesn't really get at your question about the MDA's delegation, but other states, so that the members know, it's not just us, but other agencies in other states have said, waters of the state's fine for us.
Okay. Thank you. Any further questions? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Clavin, on that, though, you mentioned California, and I would assume that could be the result of endless litigation on what Swank and Rapinos mean on terms of navigability, because I'm not sure that's been the whole last 8 to 10 years of what do they mean, and what they mean in terms of what are waters of the U.S., in terms of navigable waters, will be up to each judge in each lawsuit, which I would think may not be what you want.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, that is a possibility, and for the members knowing, Rapinos, I've heard it both ways, was a wetland case from probably a decade ago, which triggered this whole conversation about what is navigable and what is not, and that led to the Oberstar bill in Congress and so forth. There was a lot of litigation over that.
So, thank you. I'm going to remind the committee we will be done at noon. We got two bills up after this. We are going to get them done today. I've got a few things taking place, so if we don't get done by noon, we're coming back in at 9 o'clock tonight. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good incentive here. I'll be quick. I just wanted to be clear and on the record and the unintended consequences that I think Representative Hansen has talked about, that what the state does with a delegation of from federal authority or of federal authority for clean water in the state of Minnesota, they're delegated to protect the waters. There was talk about every drop of rain and every, well, they're delegated to protect that for all the citizens of Minnesota. It's not like we're picking on ag or anything like that. I think the intent, there's some good meaning to that, but I think we need to be careful that we don't have unintended consequences and we end up with the federal government coming breathing down our necks. And, you know, other states do a lot of things. A lot of things I could give a care less that they're doing. I think Minnesota's plenty smart to do what we need to do. So I'm not all out there to follow other states. But let's just be sure that we aren't stepping into a larger trap here and into some litigation that's going to lead us down a longer road of litigation. That's my concern on it.
Any further questions, members? Any further questions? Representative Anderson? Any closing comments?
Mr. Chair, I guess the consequence I would like to see is for production agriculture to be saddled with more regulations that, frankly, we don't feel are necessary. That the Department of Ag is doing a very adequate job of licensing and permitting the application of production agriculture chemicals in this state. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would just renew my motion to pass House File 1122 to be put on the General Register.
Representative Anderson renews his motion that House File 1122, as amended, be recommended to pass and placed on the General Register, and to cover my bases, and may also be considered for possible inclusion. Is there any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, members. Ms. Harmon went to find Representative Gruenhagen. Like I said, he is in committee. Members, what I would like to do at this moment in time, and if you allow me to do it from right here, I'm a little gimpy. All right, I'm going to play that card today. A little gimpy. What I would like to do is I have a clone bill. It's House File 1121. I'd like to move House File 1121 be recommended to pass, be placed on the General Register. Again, it's a clone bill. You know what? We had Representative Hansen. We had that discussion on the DE1 amendment. Mr. Sullivan, would I be able to use the same DE1 amendment to get it in the same shape? Would that be adequate?
Mr. Chair and members, Mr. Reinholdt and I discussed that too, and we think it would be. Members have the 1121 DE1 before them. Without the amendment that was put on to line 1.1 last time. So, the record will show that the committee adopted the same amendment, but I think as long as the minutes are clear about what the committee's intent was, that would be fine.
All right. So I'm going to make the motion for the H1121 DE1 amendment. And just so the record shows, it's not as amended. So it's the original amendment, to put the bill in the shape that the author would like it. Any discussion? Representative Hansen, is that all right?
Representative Hansen. Good job.
All right. Thank you. Now, you know what? Chairman Junkie would charge you $5 to put in the kitty, and I'm going to follow up on that. Any other discussion besides your wife? I'm losing total control here.
I move to be ejected from the room.
All right, any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. To the bill, House File 1121 as amended. I'm going to renew any discussion. This is identical now. We just heard. Hearing none, I'm going to renew my motion. House File 1121 be recommended passed as amended. Any further discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevailed. Thank you, members. That was quick. No one wants to come back at 9 o'clock except Representative Gruenhagen. Where's he at?
I've seen him. He's over. He's across the hall.
Oh. Is he?
Yeah.
And Michael ran over to get him right across the hall.
He didn't know where he was at.
Or Arlen?
Hey.
There he is.
Where's the candy?
Cars?
Hey, there it is.
Right here.
All right. Representative Gruenhagen, you should have brought some candy or something today.
Mr. Chair, just one comment on the candy. Because of late night committee meetings last night and early ones this morning, on the way over here, I happened to buy those from a guy on a street corner. He guaranteed me they were less than 5 years old. Okay.
All right,
just kidding.
Thank you. Welcome, Representative Gruenhagen. I'm going to move House File 467 be recommended to pass, and it's heading to Ways and Means, correct? Recommended to pass and be sent to Ways and Means. Representative Gruenhagen, I believe you have, you're also wanting to offer up an amendment. We talked earlier. Are you okay if I go ahead and offer that at this time?
Sure.
All right. Members, I would like to offer the amendment on lines 1.13, an oral amendment here, after the period from grown. It says grown period on lines 1.13. Strike the commissioner may sell, comma, for profit, comma, produce. And then on lines 1.14, strike that cannot be donated, period. So So on lines 1.13, after grown, period, everything thereafter. On lines 1.13, strike that, and lines 1.14, strike that as well. Any discussion to the oral amendment? Hearing none, all those in favor to the oral amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Gruenhagen, to your bill.
Yeah, members, the reason it came to this committee is because of that provision. That was the main bone of contention, and I've decided to take it out. The other thing about the bill, just to be brief, is that there can be a tremendous amount of savings in terms of food costs to our prisons, depending on the amount of gardening that goes on. The interesting thing, there's also a reduction of recidivism in the states that have this. San Francisco practices this, Oklahoma, Georgia, I also believe North Carolina. So this also is supported by the Commissioner of Corrections, Mr. Tom Roy, and there is a person here, if you'd like to come forward, from the department if anyone has any questions. But, you know, one of the things that happened between me not being here on Monday, which, by the way, my LA was sick, that's not an excuse, it's a reason, and there was some confusion, I apologize for that. But I received a letter between Tuesday and now from an inmate who became aware of the bill, okay? And I'd just like to read a brief paragraph from him. He's an inmate here in Minnesota. He said, "Inmates need jobs, fresh produce, and a way for the existing DOC budget to be spent in the most beneficial area. Where I am currently housed has the highest idle rate in the DOC. It is not because inmates choose not to work, but rather because they are not provided jobs and then receive loss of privileges because of it. Idle rate is a measure that the DOC uses in its report to the legislature, but it only measures how many jobs they choose to provide, not how well they are instilling the motivation to work. By the way, I personally support chain gangs," which has been a little controversial. But, hey, because work is one of the best medicines for wrong behavior. It's a sort of rigged statistic. And then he goes on to say, "This program could provide some much-needed jobs, which I am an emphatic supporter of." With that, Mr. Chair, I would stand for any questions. And do you have any comments?
So, as testifier, please state your name, who you represent for the record, and begin, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is David Christ. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Facilities Division of the Department of Corrections. And I'll just reiterate the department's support for the bill.
Well, welcome and thank you. Appreciate that. Members, any questions? Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering how we start a new program when we're cutting budgets. How do we? Who's going to supervise this? How's this going to work when we're cutting staff?
Mr. Frist.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hanson, it's my understanding from the committee in public safety that it's Representative Gruenhagen's intent that we start off small with this and work our way up. Some of the programs across the country that have tried to get into this in a big way have failed because they didn't anticipate some of the scale. The fiscal note that the department has provided for this bill indicates a startup cost in 8 different facilities at about $1,000 per facility in the first year and about $500 a year after that to continue it, and no need to dedicate additional staff to the supervision of the work in the gardens.
Follow up? No. We have Representative Torkelson is next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question for Representative Gruenhagen. Was this intended to be outdoor gardening only, or would this also possibly include indoor gardening?
I'm leaving that to the discretion of the Department of Corrections on how to implement. I think the initial perspective is to be outdoor gardening.
Representative Torkelson? No. Representative Anderson. Paul.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, do you envision this as little garden spots out in the courtyard, or would we be having like work release from Stillwater to go down to garden spots downtown, or how do you envision the actual locations for these?
Mr. Chris.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, to start out, it would be we would consider plots on our minimum security facilities on our property, the property of our facilities, and perhaps at some of our medium security facilities. So we wouldn't be sending offenders into communities to do this activity. It would either be behind the secure perimeter of some of our facilities, or it would be at our minimum security facilities where the local communities are used to having offenders a little bit more out and about.
We have Representative Ward, Fritz, and Szymanski. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, members, I have experience in this, working in a garden, in egg production in a corrections facility. And some of you are thinking right now, as a resident, and I want to clarify that. One of my first teaching jobs was at the Northeast Regional Correction Center up in Saginaw, Minnesota. And besides our education program, we had a huge vocational program up there, and part of that component was an egg component. Deputy Commissioner, Assistant Commissioner, are there any current egg programs going on in a current medium maximum security facilities right now?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ward, there is a small garden program at the Shakopee facility which covers all of our security classifications, but that's the only one.
Thank you. And follow up, Mr. Chair. And thank you for that. So the program that we had at the Northeast Regional Correction Center up in Saginaw, Representative Grunhagen, was huge, and it was and everything that inmate said, that resident said, is true. It provides useful time. It builds self-esteem. It provides job skills. All of that is very, very important. However, the program that we had at Northeast Regional Correction Center was significant to the point of needing staff and needing lots of equipment. The $8,000 that I see, I think it's an $8,000 startup, and then $4,000 after that. I'm not sure that that's I understand your purpose, and I think it's very worthwhile, but I'm concerned about the appropriations amount for that, and fulfilling the what you hope to fulfill here. So I that's concerning. And I'm also thankful that we're not now competing with our local farmers. I had some local farmers that this was going to compete with them, and I'm thankful for that we're not competing with them. But I just wanted to make that comment that, I've seen it in operations, members, and it does what it's intended to do, but it takes money to do that. And Representative Hansen already pointed out that, we don't have any money to do anything, so I would just offer that piece of information.
Thank you, Representative Ward. We have three more minutes.
Okay. Ms. Chair, just briefly, thank you for those comments, Representative Ward. One of the things that this program does, it does help reduce food costs in most other states. So I think there'll be some offsetting savings in terms of the food costs, depending on the size of the program. According to the commissioner's testimony at the previous committee, it won't be that much initially. It'll be a smaller amount, similar to the fiscal note. But you might be able to offset some of the food costs with the fiscal note costs with the reduction in your food costs. Second thing is, the commissioner testified at the last committee that he wants to start on a small scale. Okay,
right.
So he's not going to go out there and try and implement. In fact, at the last committee, I gave two examples. I don't have it right in front of me, so I won't name the states, but two where they tried to go large right off the bat, and like the assistant commissioner testified, they had failure because of that. So I think it's better off starting small. There is some money in here for initial tools and those types of things. In some states, they actually had them donated. So I'm sure that the commissioner will look to have something like that done. And
Representative Grunhagen, I think you're losing votes, my friend.
Oh, okay.
You're being summoned in another committee as well. Do we have anybody else that would like to testify for or against this bill quickly? make your way up. Hearing none, Representative Fritz, thank you for taking your name off the list. Is Representative Schimanski willing to take his name off the list? Is there any further discussion? I'm going to renew my motion that House File 467 be recommended to pass as amended and head to Ways and Means Committee. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen.
Yep, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Committee, buddy. We are adjourned.